Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. There was a moment when C.S. Lewis miscalled the Bishop of Woolwich the Bishop of Woolworth. Woolworth is a department store that sells very cheap goods, or at least it used to, before it went out of business. And in that moment, C.S. Lewis began to describe his contempt for modernism in the Church of England, for this new liberalizing relativistic theology that he thought was completely antithetic to the Christian faith. Well, the times they are changing. Modernism has certainly grasped the Church of England, and many people ask whether or not C.S. Lewis would have become a Roman Catholic. Let me read for a moment from Joseph Pearce, who wrote a book called C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, because I think Pearce sets the scene beautifully for us today. He writes, "We can't know for certain what Lewis would have done had he lived to see the triumph of modernism in the Church of England and the defeat of mere Christianity. There is no doubt, however, he would have felt strangely out of place in today's Anglican Church. There's also no doubt that today's Anglican Church sees him as a somewhat embarrassing part of their unenlightened and reactionary past. The sobering truth is that even if Lewis had not chosen to leave the Church of England has chosen to leave him." Who is still reading the books of C.S. Lewis? If not the Anglicans, who's responsible for his continuing popularity? Walter Hooper, his literary executor to the C.S. Lewis estate, is more qualified than anyone else to answer such a question. And Hooper writes, "I can say with absolute confidence that more and more Catholics are buying his books now, because most of the translations that I've seen in recent years have come from Catholic countries. In many instances, it's Catholic publishers who are translating Lewis, as in Italy. The same is true in Spain, where the translations are the work of Opus Dei. So we know that Catholics are reading them in vast numbers throughout the world." Father Michael Ward is an ex-Anglican. He's a literary critic and theologian. His academic focus is on the theological imagination, especially in the writings of Lewis, Tolkien and Chesterton. And he's best known, he's famous, for his book Planet Narnia, in which he cracked the key to the Narnia Chronicles by arguing that Lewis structured the Chronicles of Narnia so as to embody and express the imagery of the seventh heavens. As well as an academic, he became an Anglican priest and then became a member of the Ordinariate. He's one of the most informed Lewis scholars today, having made the journey from the Church of England to Rome. And he joins me now. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to meet you. I've seen you on YouTube and I've read your books and enjoyed enormously both what you brought to C.S. Lewis scholarship and your own journey. And of course, we're dealing with three journeys, I suppose, if you include mine, but we won't be talking about mine. But two journeys towards Catholicism, yours and perhaps C.S. Lewis's. We'll try and unwrap that. Not everyone on the Catholic Herald, or indeed coming to this YouTube channel, will know about your own journey. But it began as an Anglican ordinand, took you through postgraduate Inklings work, Lewis, and then after writing a spectacularly successful book, you yourself moved from Anglicanism to Rome. Would you like to sum up for our readers in whatever form you think works best for you and for them, your own journey from the Church of England to becoming a Roman Catholic priest?
Thank you, Gavin. I'm glad to be with you. Yes, it was a long journey. I was raised as a very low church evangelical kind of Anglican, very much in the John Stott kind of mould, which was somewhat anti-papistical, it must be said. And I don't think I knew a Catholic, at least I didn't know that I knew any Catholics, until I came to Oxford to do my undergraduate degree. And I was very suspicious about them. Indeed, I was suspicious about high church Anglicans, you know, Anglo-Catholics.
Quite right.
But when I began to meet them and realised that they didn't have two heads and that some of them were obviously quite godly people, you know, even holier than I was, if such a thing can be imagined.
Scarcely.
well, in fact, I mean, just I ought to go back, actually, you know, growing up even in that context, but reading Lewis and Tolkien and Chesterton and others already began to scour away some of my anti-Catholic barnacles. So I was pretty ready to, as it were, move up the candle, and I gradually did over the years. And when I went off to Ridley Hall in Cambridge to do my ordinand training, I was attached to Peterhouse Chapel and then to Little St Mary's, both of which were fairly high up the candle. So I was already, you know, experiencing the upper reaches of Anglicanism. But still, as you know, though you can be very close on the ground, as it were, between an Anglo-Catholic and a Catholic, there's a big and sometimes invisible high glass fence dividing you from Rome. And I was not thinking at all that I would end up in the Catholic Church. But from 1992 onwards, I was increasingly dissatisfied with the Church of England and questioning its claims to authority. 1992, of course, being the General Synod's vote to start ordaining women, which I was troubled by not so much because of the substance of the question at hand, but because of the question of authority that underlay it. What gave the General Synod authority to decide this issue, or for that matter, any issue? And that was a question I'd never really tackled before. When I was doing my ordinand training, I began looking for the first time at Catholic teaching on sexual ethics, read some encyclicals, Humanae Vitae, and things like that, and began to think they make sense. This is good. It's hard teaching, but it hangs together much better than anything I'm receiving, alas, in the Anglican Church. So some of my reservations about Anglicanism were increasing. Some of my attractions to Catholicism were increasing. And gradually I got more and more dissatisfied with the Church of England, so much so that when I was chaplain of St. Peter's College at Oxford, as I was for 3 years, I found myself during the vacations unable to find a church in Oxford that I was willing to attend, that I was happy to attend. And I thought, this is a bad sign, because there are so many Anglican churches in Oxford. If you can't find one that suits your particular temperament and taste, you must be a very peculiar fish indeed. And I began to realize, oh dear, I belong to the Church of Michael Ward. When I'm in charge of services in college term time, I'm very happy to go, but outside term, not so much. So I began to see that there was a fork in the road ahead of me, and that either I would I become a Catholic, or, and this is the first time it had ever occurred to me, I would cease to be a Christian altogether. But ceasing to be a Christian was not a serious possibility, I knew that. So the only way was on to Rome, across the Tiber. And around about that time, I was blessed with a new friend in the form of an Oxford student who had himself recently crossed the Tiber from American evangelicalism. He'd been a student at Wheaton College, and he began pummeling away at my residual Anglicanism and my residual hostility to Catholicism. And it all came down eventually to the question of authority and who I should trust and who I could believe to be a valid claimant to the authority of Christ himself. Because, of course, I would always say that I would follow Christ wherever he lay, wherever he led me. But how did I know where he would lead me? I needed an authoritative guide to what Christ taught and where Christ was leading. And I hadn't really resolved that question satisfactorily within Anglicanism. And as for Catholicism, I thought, well, the papal claims are a bit rich, aren't they? You know, sign up to that and I could be led anywhere. But when I realized, oh, well, I've already signed up in principle to be led anywhere by being a Christian. And if the Church of Rome, if the Catholic Church's claim to be a valid interpreter of Christ is indeed true, then in following the Pope and the Magisterium and the tradition of the Church, I'm doing nothing different in principle from what I was already willing to do. It's just I now had an adequate and coherent understanding of authority, which I'd never had before. And so as soon as I saw it in that light, I realized there was really no problem. And although there were certain questions about Catholic teaching I still had questions about, I thought, well, if I can believe that the Church knows what it's talking about, I will just have to trust and allow myself to be taught on questions like, you know, certain Marian dogmas, which I was still struggling with a bit. So I took the leap. It's not so much a leap. It was more a steady progression. Father John Sayward here in Oxford and prepared me for reception into the Church, and I was received by him at the St. Gregory's and St. Augustine's Church on Michaelmas Day 2012.
Wonderful. That's very clear. Thank you so much. And it ties together some things I hope we can talk about. I think this may be essentially, we'll focus on authority because for me, the magisterium became, the missing magisterium in Anglicanism, became exactly the same provocative agency that you've described it as. And I don't think we need to, obviously we don't need to be critical of Anglicanism, but perhaps it's worth saying, perhaps you'll say it for us, that one of the things we're looking at is the change in the nature of denominationalism. So I take it for granted that the Roman Catholic Church hasn't changed. It's certainly vulnerable to the bufferings of cultural conflicts, but its major claim is the umbilical cord through to the apostles and the teaching of Christ. But the Anglican Church in our lifetime has changed. And as you say, it changed particularly in 1992. And curiously enough, one of the people to perceive that change and offer both a diagnosis and a prognosis was C.S. Lewis in his prescient but very condensed essay on priestesses. And I remember the first time I read that, I thought, gosh, this is huge. Why aren't people talking about this and all the elements in it? Why is it? The thing that surprised me enormously, I was on General Synod for 20 years. There was never a theological conversation, either about authority or about sexuality or about the priesthood. It was all political, as if there was no other language. There should have been another language in Anglicanism, but certainly no one spoke it in public if there was. Let's go back to authority and Lewis. Can I make the suggestion that it seems to me that Lewis is a compartmentalized man, as we all are. We both know him to be an expert scholar on and medievalist. But it's almost as if he, to my mind, he located his life in different compartments. And the authority lay in a kind of supremely gifted rationalism, which he possessed. In other words, in the same way that you described yourself as faced with the awful prospect of joining the Church of Michael Ward, it seems to me that within Anglicanism, Lewis had almost created the Church of C.S. Lewis, a very good one. I mean, as polished and as competent and as resourced and as rich as you could ever ask for. But that one of the reasons, as people ask why he didn't go on an ecclesial journey, was because he was Anglicanism allowed him to be judge and jury in his own theological quest. And as it happened, that worked out very well during his lifetime. Do you want to take that and test it a bit and maybe expand it?
Yes, well, I think that you're right in everything you say and in the way that you say it, which is, you know, charitable and accepting. He was a marvellous gift to the Church, Catholic, you know, in the widest sense of that term, and has done more than many Catholic evangelists in bringing people into the Catholic Church. You begin reading Lewis, then you're reading Tolkien, then you're reading Chesterton, and then you find yourself Catholic.
Something like that. Yes.
Lots of people have described that trajectory. Because Lewis was very Catholic friendly, even though he never got there himself. And I think there was no sign that he ever came really close to becoming a Catholic. He was very warmly disposed to the whole Catholic mentality and framework, except for, as you say, the crucial question of papal magisterial authority. But because he placed such an emphasis upon the grand tradition, upon mere Christianity, the Vincentian canon of what's been believed by everybody everywhere at all times, that made him sort of Catholic in almost every respect, willy-nilly. The only problem, of course, with the Vincentian canon is that sometimes what is believed by almost everyone is incorrect. Just think of the Arian controversy and how Athanasius stood contra mundum. It's Athanasius against the world, and Athanasius turned out to be correct. But if you went simply on a majoritarian rule, Athanasius would have been ruled a heretic. So the Vincentian canon isn't actually a sufficient and adequate rule of faith when you press into it.
I was reading you saying that as I did my homework and thought, well, that's clearly quite right. Obviously, that's true. Except, I suppose it partly depends on time scale. If one sees, I mean, the Arian controversy lasted a remarkably long time, terrifyingly long time, in fact. But nonetheless, it didn't survive. It didn't survive the tectonic plates of orthodoxy ultimately. So, I mean, can we allow the Vincentian canon? If we take it over a longer time scale, in other words, obviously there are going to be places in the life of the church where aberrations take place, but we judge them perhaps by trajectory. But that's probably an argument ought to have another time. I'd like to distinguish a bit between cultural Catholicism and the Catholicism of the imagination. Quite clearly, Lewis was in his imaginative world a Catholic, a sacramentalist. Believed in purgatory, in fact wrote about purgatory better than almost anybody else I've ever met, apart from Dante maybe, but he didn't write about Mary, did he? So well, first of all, what I should say, and again you've said it very clearly, he suffered very profoundly from an Ulster prejudice, I think, that almost how could anyone born in Ulster easily become a Catholic with that ingrained tribal anxiety, which I assume operates at a number of levels, social, psychological, in the water, but also spiritual. It strikes me that there must be a spiritual element, which Lewis himself was absolutely brilliant at describing, both in all his letters of in all his works of conflict. People get blinded and simply can't see something. He had a sacramental and a Catholic theological imagination. But I don't think he wrote about Our Lady at all, did he? And of course, and he couldn't cope with the idea of the papacy or relinquish authority. Can you square that circle at all? Develop that?
Yes, well, back to the question of authority just for a moment. Christopher Derrick wrote a very good book called C.S. Lewis and the Church of Rome, in which he, very patiently and ironically explores Lewis's own ecclesiology, which is not ever very carefully developed in any of his works. It's the one theological subject above any other that he avoided at nearly all costs, because of
Very
course.
very Anglican.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, John Betjeman, the wide high table logos of St. C.S. Lewis's church, I think Lewis did, in a way, construct his own ecclesiology, based on a Catholic version of Anglicanism, with the two major exceptions of papal authority and Marian dogmas. And it's amazing how very Catholic you can be even without those two things.
Yes.
But of course, it's not a recipe for a secure foundation, and for dealing with development of doctrine. That's one of the main warrants, isn't it, for papal authority, that it's the living voice that can decree this way and not that when a controversy arises. And interestingly, Lewis wrote an essay called Dogma and the Universe, in which he talks about how Christian dogma, though being a deposit of faith and in a sense set and immutable, can nonetheless develop. And he doesn't talk about Newman and the development of doctrine at all in that essay, but basically what he's arguing for or defending is a very Newmanian understanding of how Christian doctrine does unfold over time. It's just the one thing he doesn't countenance is the referee, the authorized, properly constituted referee who makes the calls. As for Mary, you're quite right. He said in public almost nothing about Mary, and very little even in his letters. It's a subject he liked to avoid as much as possible. He does touch upon it, he touches upon why he's not going to talk about it in the preface to Mere Christianity, where he says that, apart from anything else, one of the things that provides causes a problem when talking about Mary is not only that Catholics have a certain set of beliefs about Mary, but they have certain devotions to her. And you can't really dispute or disagree with the doctrines without also making yourself to appear something like a cad, as if you're criticizing someone else's mother.
which you would be, yes.
which you would indeed be. So he steers clear of it, absolutely. But just once or twice in his letters, he says, there's no point in going to, praying to Mary. Why not pray to the Lord? If the Blessed Virgin is as good as the best mothers I have known, she wouldn't want any attention directed to her that should be directed towards her son. Which completely misses the point. Which elsewhere Lewis accepts absolutely, that God and creation are not in a competitive rivalry with each other, and that you can indeed attend to the creature without in any way what's the right word? Diminishing the glory given to the creator. You glorify the creator in the creature. And he understands that in other places, but not when it comes to invocation of the saints.
It seems to me, reading Lewis, that I mean, he has such a muscular mind, and he knew he had a muscular mind. I mean, he went to great lengths to think very clearly. I mean, as you pointed out a number of times, as well as being an author and an English scholar, he trained as a philosopher originally. And one, I get this sense that Lewis, there are points at which he's not going to surrender his autonomy. And I think Our Lady, in a semi-conscious way, is a threat to rational individual autonomy. And I suspect he knew that, and this passage in Mere Christianity is a form of special pleading to keep her away. Not entirely offering the real reason, but a reason. And if people accept the a reason, then he doesn't have to deal with it. One of the things I don't think he's given much credit for, and I think he ought to be, it seems to me he must have had the most profound spiritual struggle with evil. Because only somebody who had encountered the devil and the demonic would be able to turn it into a humorous sketch in order to allow other people access to something that is both enormously important, quite alarming, very dangerous, difficult to manage in a balanced way. And although he doesn't, a bit like St. Paul, who only at one point launches out into, I know a man once upon a time was in or out of the body, I don't know, who knows, and then does this sort of semi-agnostic biographical thing. Lewis seems to be doing that in the Screwtape Letters and also perhaps in The Great Divorce. He knows a man who's been there, had these experiences, fought those temptations and done it, but with humility and also great skill, knowing that other people will come to this more easily through the narrative imagination. He places it in the public domain. I think it's one of his most powerful triumphs as a Christian writer of spirituality, to be able to, if you like, that play that trick on all of us, pretend it's a child's game and then inviting us to walk in there and discover that although we need that simple understanding, we're actually involved in the same life or death struggle that his characters are in the narratives he weaves.
Absolutely. He says in Surprised by Joy, his autobiography, that he did at a certain period of his life dabble a little bit in the occult. He doesn't go into any detail, and I don't think he got very far into it, but he poked his nose round the corner, as it were. And then he had a terrifying experience in his 20s when Dr. John Askins, the brother of Mrs. Moore, the woman who he lived with, who was staying with them in Oxford, went mad, began sort of foaming at the mouth and writhing on the ground and shrieking out that he was being dragged down to hell. And this was in the days, you know, long before the National Health Service, where you could just have bundled him off to the local lunatic asylum. So for 2 weeks, Lewis and others sort of held him down while he frothed and raved. And this was a really shocking experience for Lewis. And ever after that, I think he realized how tenuous the hold we have on our mental health is, let alone our spiritual well-being. And I think that's one of the reasons why he did adopt this sort of middle of the road, lights on, safety first approach, which was not just a psychological strategy, but also I think probably bled into his ecclesiology, that he thought, well, the middle of the middle is the way to go. And, you know, the Church of England is the via media between Geneva and Rome. And I'll be an absolutely centrist kind of middleman. I won't be particularly high, nor particularly low, nor particularly anything else as an Anglican. That's how he describes himself in the preface to Mere Christianity. And I think that's how he found sanity and security. And from that position, he did a great deal of good. And it's not for us to, you know, judge another's servant, so I'm not going to start criticizing him. It's a very awkward thing to talk about, another man's spiritual journey and why it didn't go where we think it ought to have gone. But who are we to have an opinion on it? I think I can say Lewis was an honest man and followed the light that he was granted. And he was, for some peculiar reason, not granted the light to lead him into the Catholic Church. But that's a mystery. That's in God's providence. And I don't know that I can say much more than that.
No, I don't think any of us can. I'm very aware, although I'm fairly bullish about why I've become a Catholic and why I think other people ought to become a Catholic. There's a caveat, which I don't make often enough, which is it took me an awfully long time. I mean, like you, I had all the kind of sacramental nostalgia, the appetite for sacramental nostalgia keenly alerted. And I loved nothing better than reading Teresa of Avila and St. Seraphima Sarov and feeling myself on home ground. But this notion, I think people underestimate the notion of surrender. I found having to surrender myself to the papacy, and the magisterium, to the authority of the church, no longer to have my opinions matter theologically. I found that really devastatingly difficult. And I don't think I could have come to it easily if the ground under my feet as an Anglican hadn't begun to perilously give way as it did. I'm not sure I'd had the grace or the humility or the clarity to make the journey I should have made, and I'm delighted to have made. And in a sense, I don't blame Lewis at all, because during his lifetime, although again presciently he saw it giving way under the Bishop of Woolworth, during his lifetime it hadn't given away. He warned it might do, but it stayed sufficiently solid for him to be an orthodox, and it's because it's very difficult to know what to call him, because to call him conservative and traditional and orthodox, really, all these words are enormously problematic, even to call him a mere Christian, to use his own language. But he seemed to me to have prayed his way, fought his way, struggled his way into the center of what it was to be a Christian, without being forced to walk the road to the end, as you and I did, because the ground under our feet gave way.
Yes, well said. When one bears in mind that he died in 1963, and when one calculates from that date how relatively unchanged Anglicanism was, and also how, closed in on itself Catholicism was, because we tend to forget how transformative the Second Vatican Council was for the Catholic Church worldwide. When we think, oh, this is before the pontificate of John Paul II, which had such a major effect upon all sorts of Protestants around the world, because they saw this holy man, this great leader, for 20 odd years leading the Catholic Church, and you only had to look at John Paul II on television to see, oh, this is clearly a godly man. But I'm not sure that C.S. Lewis would ever have watched a television, let alone watched a pope on a television. So it was all sort of foreign, and the Catholics that he knew, one or two notable exceptions like Tolkien, put to one side, but in the mass, in generally speaking, Catholics in England of his day were, immigrant Irish and Italians. They weren't true-born patriotic Englishmen. And yeah, of course, he always had to accept Tolkien and Elgar and Chesterton and a long list of exceptions. But still, Catholics were foreigners, and they weren't loyal to the crown and all that. But you talked about surrender, and he talks a good deal about surrender, his need to surrender his own lawlessness and individualism. He talks about that in Surprised by Joy, and he did surrender it to God in Christ, but that didn't, as it were, instantiate itself in an ecclesiological surrender. And why that is the case is hidden in the mystery of his personality and the purposes of God. I mean, Peter Kraft, perhaps slightly tongue in cheek, says, and I'm not quite sure of the theological validity of this, but that C.S. Lewis didn't become a Catholic because God didn't want him to become a Catholic. And you can't really defend that logically, that Lewis did more for the Church Catholic by remaining outside of it than he would have done if he'd crossed the Tiber.
Do you know, but I can see that because it's not a logical proposition, but it's a vocational one. And so, and all our vocations are contextual as well. And I can see that in a way, Lewis can exercise a more effective Catholic apostolate. And Catholic there, I mean, with both a large C and a small c. I mean, and I'm talking about Orthodox Christianity, the Orthodox faith. In a way, he's able to do that, partly because he stood at the crossroads, I think, of the clash of two cultures. So again, during your and my lifetime, it seems to me that the Reformation fights should have come to an end. I mean, our lifetimes ought to mark the end, I think, of the scrapping of the theological arguments of the 16th and 17th century. They're no longer pertinent. And despite the fact that a number of Protestant denominations, including the Church of England, have them written into their DNA, they're wrong to do so, because we don't need to look back and continually fight the battles of our ancestors. But during our lifetimes, a new schism has appeared, not within the Church Catholic in the way that the First Reformation did, but between Christian Orthodoxy and Christian liberalism. Christian liberalism being a form, I suppose, of both Protestantism and atheism, but a repudiation of authority, a celebration of the anarchic individual who makes his own choices wherever they lead them, whatever the consequences are. And one of the things that I found myself saying for quite a lot of my adult life is, I don't feel really much need to deal with Calvinistic or Zwinglian or Erastian difficulty. What I want to do is to distinguish between the central character of Christian belief and the ephemeral challenges that have come in from offside. And I think Lewis is almost one of the most powerful proponents of Christian orthodoxy in the face of, well, what have turned out to be, since his death, 60 years of the most profound, disturbing assaults on the cogency, on the, well, we're back to authority again. He may not have managed the authority of the church, but he certainly managed to present the authority of the faith in the face of challenges to it. And so I can see him being better able to do that in the middle ground of Anglicanism as it was than if he'd been a card-carrying Catholic. After all, Tolkien doesn't do that. I mean, Tolkien does something completely different with his imagination of the Middle Earth, but he doesn't have the same evangelistic effect as Lewis does. Tolkien seems to me to offer a reconfiguration of the imaginative unconscious so that you find yourself ready to be able to accept the cosmology of Christianity without knowing it. But Lewis does it much more directly, making direct claims that people have to accept or reject. And I can well see that might have been hampered by being a Catholic in the 50s or the 60s.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely. And I think another reason why Lewis was so helpful for the Church Catholic, in the broadest sense of that phrase, derives not just from this wish to be centrist that I've already talked about, but this wish to be logical, to be rational. Because an absolutely crucial element in Lewis's formation, I think, was his own philosophical development and his overcoming of solipsism and subjectivism, which comes to its best fruition in his work, The Abolition of Man, but which is everywhere to be seen in his writings and his thought, that value is objective. Goodness, truth, and beauty are objective. We do not make them up, we discover them. And that was so foundational for Lewis, just intellectually, let alone spiritually, that he has found a ready audience amongst many Catholics, including popes. You know, Benedict XVI spoke very highly of The Abolition of Man, gave extensive remarks about it in a lecture he delivered in Cambridge many years ago when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger. John Paul II greatly admired the Four Loves.
Can I dive into a footnote for a moment?
Yes.
Ask a more technical question. This is my mode of self-indulgence for me, if you don't mind. It's something I've wanted to ask you. So listeners, please forgive me whilst I make use of Father Michael's expertise. There's a wonderful Orthodox axiom which says the purpose of the for the human life is to stand before the real God with the real self, with the mind and the heart. And I've always found this to be theologically and spiritually enormously enriching. Reading The Abolition of Man and watching there Lewis offer some form of arbitration, almost a Freudian arbitration between the ego, the superego, and the id, but it isn't that, but it's structured in a similar way, between the head, the chest or the heart, and the bowels or the animal instincts. It seems to me when he talks about the chest, he's very close to talking about the heart in the way that the Orthodox tradition do it. And this is the critical bit. The Orthodox give primacy to the heart, to stand with the head in the heart in a way that our theological tradition finds very difficult, and I must say I found difficult for a long time. But is not Lewis struggling with the same issues as he tries to find some form of salvific arbitration between rationality, whatever you'd call the chest of the heart in theological terms, and then the lower instincts and appetites.
Oh, that's a that's a deep and difficult set of questions. And I don't know enough about Freudianism. I don't know enough about Orthodox theology to answer in any very adequate sense. All I will say is that, yes, you're quite right, that Lewis's heart or chest, as he develops it in The Abolition of Man and elsewhere, is close to a theological term. I think it's not just a philosophical term, even though The Abolition of Man is an avowed work of philosophy.
Yes, that's what I thought was so interesting about it, because it seemed to me that, you know, he was coming to us as a philosopher, and ever so helpfully, as you say, it's a difficult book and not many people manage to make friends with it. But I thought part of its beauty, its temptation almost, was that he was standing over these two worlds. The theological world keeps on breaking in implicitly, and although he was, I think, driving the reader in a different direction, to warn of the great collapse, which in fact we're enmeshed in, you know, at this very moment we're enmeshed exactly in the collapse that he warned of if we didn't get the balance right. There were all kinds of sub issues creeping in, which I thought might be talking about. But let me not press you on that, because I want to take you somewhere else. But again, you may please feel free to resist, because I think this is a difficult area, and I go into it with some trepidation. And it's Mrs. Moore. And the reason, so you'll understand the trepidation, and I don't want to make any aspersions that we don't have any cause to make. But I'm very moved by the way in which Lewis seems to have a powerful sexual ethic. He's very clear about the uncompromising ethics that our sexual appetites present us with, and also of marriage, and the whole devastating experience of falling in love with Joy and marrying her, desperately asking for the church's blessing on it in circumstances that the devotees of Lewis are very familiar with. It did occur to me that if he has, let us euphemistically say, an unorthodox relationship with Mrs. Moore in the early days, he served a kind of penance by looking after her while she became a very difficult and crotchety old lady. I mean, whatever the comforts were or weren't, we don't know. It's not for us to care. I'm just in awe of his generosity, his patience, and his kindness. And I wonder if something in all of that didn't deepen his sense of how critical the issues were and how important it was to come up with orthodox answers to heterodox challenges. Do you have anything to say to us about that? You'll be better read on this than I am.
Well, you're quite right that he did have, let us euphemistically call it, an unorthodox relationship with Mrs. Moore in the early years, in his 20s, before he became a Christian. I think that question has now been settled conclusively. For those who want the evidence, I point them to Walter Hooper's posthumous statement on the website of the Wade Centre at Wheaton College. He left it to be published after his death. But there he says quite clearly that Owen Barfield told him that Lewis had told Barfield that, yes, there was a sexual relationship between Lewis and Mrs. Moore in the 20s, and that it ceased around about the time he became a Christian. Now, this is none of our business. It's not your business.
Right.
It's not my business. It's rather embarrassing to be talking about it. But nonetheless, as Lewis has become, as you rightly say, such a clear teacher on questions of sexual ethics, marriage, masculinity, femininity, and indeed, I would argue, up to a point at least, contraception, It's understandable that we want to know what kind of life he lived behind closed doors. You know, it's rather prurient, but you know, that's how the mind works. Well, when to put it more fairly, we don't want to know whether he walked the talk.
Well, except that, of course, none of us walk the talk. But one of the reasons I bring it up is not to be a prurient at all, but because I think sometimes it's out of our failures that we learn what really matters. And this is not Lewis as a crusty Oxford bachelor. I think this is the point that I'm hoping might emerge from this. Some people say, well, here's this crusty bachelor pontificating on sexual ethics for the rest of the world. What does he know? Who does he think he is? He does it with a certain loftiness that isn't palatable to everybody. But as we discovered, and during my lifetime, the kind of the corners were sort of lifted here, there, and everywhere. The what is very odd private life was, and of course part of this was a profound obligation to his best friend, which was a moral and noble foundation for the beginnings of the whole journey, wherever it developed. But it strikes me that I think what I want to say is this is parallel to his own struggle with the occult, or struggle with it's only by having to have struggled, if you like, and have fallen and have to get up again, that he's able to write with experience about how important it is. And it's not, we're not here to judge him as a hypocrite. That would be to miss the point entirely, and to lose the point in a degree of pharisaical self-justification. It's to say, well, he knew what he was talking about. And any person who's attempted to live a moral life and failed is entitled to talk about how important it is to attempt to live the moral life.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. We touched on how he struggled with the occult and overcame that. I touched upon his temptations towards solipsism and subjectivism and how he overcame that. And yeah, he struggled with sexual purity. Who does not?
Who doesn't? Quite exactly. It's contraception. Contraception. You said, I want to not to lose that. So one of the things you're about to say, you're going to make a case, I think, or able to make a case for him supporting the Catholic view on contraception, which is a big thing, and many people would say is one of the great watersheds in our cultural, theological, political developments. You just flagged it up and I caught it, and we're very grateful you go back to it.
Yes, I'm very interested in Lewis's attitude to contraception. I've written about it in a couple of places. I wrote an article in First Things, which you can find online. And more recently, I've done a deep dive into his novel, That Hideous Strength, which I think is largely about marriage and matrimony. Matrimony, indeed, is the very first word of that book. Matrimony meaning marriage that gives rise to motherhood. Marriage is more than just friendship. It is a, in principle, a procreative relationship. And if it is willfully stopped from being procreative, then a serious moral misstep has been made. That, I think, is largely what the novel That Hideous Strength is about. Mark and Jane Studdock have a contraceptive marriage, but by the end of the story, they're enjoying a fertile relationship. Now, why was Lewis so interested in this? I think myself that it sprang from his rigorous logical mind. He loved following chains of reasoning to, you know, their ultimate conclusion. And in 1930, as we both know, the Church of England revised its teaching on
Yeah.
contraception and opened the door, just a teeny tiny little crack, to the acceptance of contraception. And now, less than 100 years later, everybody, you know, almost everybody in the world accepts contraception, including far too many Catholics, as just a natural way of going about your sexual life. Hardly anybody thinks twice about it. But Lewis did think twice and thrice about it, because he saw where it would lead. He worked his way down that that descending staircase of manipulation of the self. I mean, this is largely what the abolition of man is about, willfully changing nature in an unnatural, anti-natural fashion to suit one's own will, one's own convenience, one's own desires. And in the abolition of man, he only glances at contraception. And so a lot of people think, oh, yes, this is about technology and, you know, genetic manipulation and, you know, fracking and all these, you know, modern instances of this manipulation. But almost nobody goes back up the chain to what I think is probably the occasioning cause of it all, which is the 1930 Lambeth Conference. And I say that in part because almost the only Anglican at the time to oppose it publicly and noisily was Charles Gore, the sometime Bishop of Oxford, who wrote a very vigorous pamphlet saying that Lambeth 1930 was disastrous. And Lewis admired Charles Gore. We don't have absolute evidence that he read this pamphlet, though I think it's highly probable, almost certain. But he did read many other of Gore's works and spoke very, very highly of them. And indeed, I suspect he was put onto those other works by the pamphlet. At any rate, I say this because in the 1930s, in 1933, his first book, The Pilgrim's Regress, is the first public statement against contraception through the mouth of Mr. Sensible in The Pilgrim's Regress, who Lewis is satirizing. And then late 30s, 1938, we have Out of the Silent Planet, which is Lewis's depiction of the masculine spirit on Mars, followed by the depiction of the feminine spirit on Venus, followed by the third book, which begins with the word matrimony. So Lewis's first major effusion as a writer of fiction was explicitly on this topic of gender and marriage.
So I think this is ever so interesting, and I'm very grateful to have this conversation, because I think one can make a case for saying that the Catholic teaching on the contraception is of such importance to what's happened to our civilization over the last 100 years that one could make a claim for Lewis's identity as a Catholic theologian, almost on this platform alone, to say that you know, while the rest of the world has thought that the Catholic Church was being regressive and fuddy-duddy and anti-liberal and unkind and unforgiving, Lewis, with his very clear sense of intellectual and spiritual perspicacity, nailed it from the beginning on an issue that most people didn't think was important. I mean, the very fact that you're having to apologize for talking about the Lambeth Conference in the 1930s, as if not very many people will realize how important it was, which they don't, is an indication of how the penny hasn't dropped yet. You know, it hasn't dropped in public that this is the cause of our moving from procreation to recreation, with all the disastrousness that flows from treating such an important gift theologically, biologically, in that way. And here, and it's Lewis, as you quite rightly say, picking this up right from the beginning and writing about it. We're probably running out of most people towards the end of most people's attention span. And I think you may have provided the answer, but I won't sort of prompt you of the books of Lewis for you yourself. A lot of people will, of course, have talked about how mere Christianity has introduced them to the faith, and how the Screwtape Letters have set them up for spiritual conflict and an understanding of the issues of being a disciple. And one of my favourites has always been The Great Divorce, as a book that's so profoundly rich at so many levels. But what would you say in terms of where we've got to now in the clash between Christianity and the culture? Some of Lewis's most useful or pertinent books, because I think it's almost like one could say, well, in this decade or these two decades, you know, this had real traction. For myself, it was The Rediscovery, because I didn't understand them the first time I read them at all, but it was The Rediscovery that the Ransom trilogies were full of the most extraordinary insight in terms both of ecology and sexuality, and I The thing about Lewis is, again, I heard you in a conversation talk about the way in which Tolkien misunderstood the depth of the Narnia stories. I remember once driving my daughter down camping in France, and we were listening to the Narnia stories on the radio, and I had to stop every half an hour or so because suddenly in the narrative, he would make the most profound theological point, hidden, discreetly wrapped up in some element of the action. And I would say to my daughter, I've got to write that down. You know, that's one can track one's way through the Narnia stories, these extraordinary stepping stones of theological bombshells, which he just slips in to the text of enormous value. And so I think a lot of people read his books without gaining a sense of the profundity that they're engaging with. As with all reading, the book reads you as much as you read the book. So for me, the Ransom trilogy has become prophetic and multi-layered in a way that I never guessed to begin with. But what would you say in your own experience at the moment is the work you reflect on and find illuminating for the moment?
Well, I mentioned I've just been writing on That Hideous Strength, and I do admire That Hideous Strength hugely and find it one of the most entertaining and moving and engaging and thought-provoking reads in the whole of Lewis's output as a writer. My essay, by the way, just for anybody who wants to catch it when it comes out later this year, is going to be published in a volume called Life on the Silent Planet, Essays
Great.
for Christian Living from Lewis's Ransom Trilogy. It's an edited volume of essays. I've just got one in a group of 20 or so contributors.
Who's publishing it?
The Davenant Institute are the people behind it. I don't know if it's their own press or some other, but the editor is Rhys Laverty, and it should be out in September or October this year, I believe.
Exciting. Great.
So that's one thing. But yes, I chime with you absolutely in your praise for the Narnia Chronicles. That's where I go back most frequently, and not just for professional literary critical reasons, but just for sheer imaginative enjoyment. It's such a sophisticatedly poetic world, Narnia, much, 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 much more so than most people give it credit for. I totally agree with you about Tolkien's imaginative evangelism, you might say, evangelizing the subconscious, or whatever it was you said. I think Lewis does a similar thing, though in a different key for a slightly different audience. But if I'm right about the underpinnings of Narnia being based on the seven heavens of the medieval cosmos and how Lewis uses that Christologically, to give each Narnia Chronicle its own internal ordering and coherence, summed up in the person of Aslan in each book, then I think that in part accounts for why the Chronicles are so satisfying. Each time you go back to them, you just feel each story has its own flavor, its own atmosphere, its own tone, which you can't easily put your finger on. As you read, I, as a literary critic, have put my finger on it rather analytically in my book, Planet Narnia, to try to explain what he's up to. But when you're just living the story, you feel it from within, which is his entire purpose. And I have felt that to be hugely illuminating in my own spiritual life, actually, because like all great poets, and I think Narnia is the work of a great poet, Lewis is expressing, you know, what oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed, giving a kind of a body to the inexpressible, so that the mind and the intellect and the heart and the will and the senses can, in interacting with this great art, live in the world more harmoniously, more competently. At any rate, this is beginning to sound perhaps absurdly inflated for what a lot of people regard as just silly children's books, but
Oh no, it isn't at all. There's a marvelous book on fairy tales. I'm just trying to remember the author, which I taught in one of my literary courses when I was a member of an English faculty. It'll come back. But the suggestion is that, of course, that the best ones are offer archetypes and narratives around archetypes we immediately understand. I mean, I've always thought that in microcosm, the best account of what we're going through in our cultural crisis is when Lewis describes the lady of the green kirtle, and as she puts this amnesiac drug into the air, and you have the children say, "Well, even if the sun doesn't shine, I choose to believe in it. I may beginning to lose access to it." And the whole, the external world stands for the metaphysical world in this particular. And then finally, there's a moment when the fire that this amnesiac drug is being put on is stomped out to the great pain and cost. But it looks, he set it up as a child's adventure. But archetypically, he's framed it in a way that describes the experience of every man and our whole culture, as we sink into a form of cultural, religious, spiritual amnesia that is fumigating our world. I think it's just the most intensely perceptive diagnosis of the human condition, and all wrapped up deceptively in a little tale that
Well
amuses the
played.
under 12s.
That's the thing. A 6-year-old child, 7-year-old child can enjoy it and derive a lot of wisdom from it without realizing it. But it does not exhaust the attention of people like you and me with all our degrees and all our education and all our experience. That's the sign of a real work of genius. By the way, I wonder if the book you were trying to remember is The Uses of Enchantment, Bruno Bettelheim.
It is. It is indeed. Yes, it's Bettelheim. Thank you very much. Bravo. I shall sleep better tonight.
Yes, a very fine book. Yeah.
It is, but I think establishing the archetypal, the way in which the human mind is structured in a particular architectural way, both sharing structure and to some extent furniture. And the art of writing is partly to write in a way that's congruent, both congruent with the unconscious as well as trying to grab our consciousness. And fairy tales are fairy tales because they work like that. And both Tolkien, it seems to me, and Lewis had a very fine understanding of the substructure of the human mind, so that when they wrote their mythopoeia, they did it in a way that was congruent with everyone's experience. So everyone likes the book because everyone recognizes the furniture of their own interiority. And I mean, I think, to be able to do that in the way that both of them did it in slightly different but complementary ways is a sign of their significance for our age.
Absolutely.
Father Michael, it's been so kind of you to make yourself available like this. I'd love to go on talking endlessly, but I suspect we've exhausted the patience of our listeners. Thank you very much. In terms of your own publications, would you just want to give, you've got this Planet Narnia, which is a description of how you cracked the key, or you cracked the code to the whole structure. And you've written this book of essays for the Ransom Trilogy. Is there anything else you want to we can usefully promote in the course of this for people to read?
Thank you. Yes, After Humanity, My Guide to the Abolition of Man is my other major work. That came out a couple of years ago. And it's an attempt to make this very difficult book, The Abolition of Man, accessible. I go through it almost line by line, sometimes word by word. Fortunately, it's a short book, so it can bear this minute microscopic attention. But because it connects with so many of Lewis's other works, both philosophical, apologetic, and indeed fictional and poetic, it turns out to be almost a kind of biographical work. You see into the corners of Lewis's life in every direction. I found it a very instructive book to write. I learned a huge amount because I'm no philosopher myself, and I was slightly outside my own comfort zone. But I'm proud of this book. And also, especially proud of the way that Word on Fire publications have rendered it in such a handsome volume. It's easily the most attractive book I've got my name on. So I do encourage people to look at that if they've got any interest in Lewis at all.
And the $64,000 question, which I'm not sure is has as obvious an answer as one would like it to, given the depth of his suspicion of the Catholic Church, and as you quite rightly described, its foreignness, its otherness, its unattractiveness to somebody at the heart of English culture as it was then. Do you think that the ground giving way under the Anglicans' feet, to the extent that it has done, would have propelled him into surrendering to the Catholic Church, as it did with you and I and countless others, but he had his own particular reasons for holding out? How do you think that would have played out had he lived to be 140 or something?
Yeah, well, who knows? In a way, it's not for us to even guess, but seeing as you ask me, and with all due, you know, reticence and provisionality, I think it's very, very hard to see how he could have continued being an Anglican.
Yeah.
That's very different from saying that he would have become a Catholic. Perhaps he would have gone over to Eastern Orthodoxy. You know, he had some Eastern Orthodox friends, the Zernovs here in Oxford. Perhaps he would have found his home there. Perhaps, you know, he would have done what I risked myself doing, that is to say, drying up altogether.
Well, except, as you say, that although that's rationally a possible outcome, that the honest person has to recognize is there, it's almost impossible once you've experienced Christ.
Oh, it is.
Personally, to go back, you know, to go back to the language of low church evangelicalism, which both you and I share, you know, it's Polycarp. He hasn't let me down for 80 years. I'm not going to do it now to him. Perhaps Orthodoxy. But well, because as you say, faced with either the Church of C.S. Lewis or atheism, Orthodoxy or perhaps the final great surrender.
Yes, the final lunacy of Romanism, as Tom somewhere said, self-mockingly calls it. Yes.
I'd better find out, because I shall quote that later on. Father Michael, thank you very much for joining us. It's been such a marvellous conversation. Very generous of you with your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Glad to be with you.